obviously most people know that one of the most powerful things to drive out demons is holy water. And the new rite of blessing actually blesses the water, so it does have a certain efficacy. But in the old rite, the salt is exercised and blessed, the oil and water is exercised and blessed, and the two are mixed. And that actually means that it brings up a particular interesting issue that has to be addressed, and that is, there's a Latin phrase which is "Orator genuit quod significat," which means prayer begets what it signifies. It's actually based on the notion of lex generis quod significat, that the law begets what it signifies. So if you enact a law, people start behaving that way. Well, it's the same thing in prayer in a certain sense. Prayer is, that gets what it signifies. So if you ask for specific things, you get specific things, and demons know this. And it's like a Simon Says game. So, you know, sometimes if you tell them stop, you know, stop X, and they're really doing Y, you know, it might look like X, they just keep doing it. So the point being is that it does get exactly what it signifies. So when water is exercised, it actually has a greater efficacy to be able to drive them out. Okay, so usually what I tell people is, I tell priests, you start doing it in the old rite, you can use it in the old rite, you don't need any further permissions because of the fact that the USCCB has conceded that they can use the old ritual to do the blessing, so I just tell them to start using it then. And especially after Summorum Pontificum and all that, everybody's kind of, it's kind of conceded that all the old books are usable. So I usually tell people, tell the priest to use them. So if you can get it blessed in the old rite, it'll actually have a greater efficacy. And this is based upon the nature of prayer. This does not mean, again, that the new rite of holy water is inefficacious. It's just not as efficacious. So if you, in the lack of the old rite of holy water, at least get some blessed holy water. Holy water may be used to spread around everywhere in houses, on people, and on things. It may also be consumed by those who are having problems. So I tell people, you know, get hordes of it made and just, you know, drink a little bit each day. Then there's what's called, and you can spread around on everything. And you should have the little holy water faucet in your house where people can use it, your kids, and you can use it regularly, so that it's regularly available. Epiphany water is even more efficacious because of the fact that there's a twofold exorcism done on it on the vigil of the Epiphany. So if you can get a hold of some of that, usually when it's made, priests will make gallons of it because of the fact that that way when people need it in the future and you just put it in the holy water font, then people actually have it. And priests, in the since the blessing can be conceded to be used by any priest, you can even use it, even if he says the new rite all the time. You can use this old book of blessings. It's not called the old book of blessings, it's actually the Roman ritual. Sometimes what exorcists will do is just something I usually do, but I haven't done it since I got here because I couldn't get any fluids on the plane. You know, you got that whole thing going on. So, but usually what exorcists will actually do is take a little bit of holy oil and add it to the holy water to boost the efficacy of it. And sometimes they found that helps. Exercise salt is also efficacious in spreading around in locations as well as consuming. As a general rule, any time I go anywhere and I'm in place for any length of time, I'm eating the salt, I exercise all the salt in the building. There was one case where I actually did that at one building, and one of the people in the building immediately became ill from eating the food. So I'm like, okay, you got a problem, bud, come on over here, you know. So it's one of those kinds of things. So it's a good diagnostic tool, you know. But anyway, the point being is that it's good to have it in the house and consume it. Have all your salt blessed. Have it all blessed. Then there's relics of saints, particularly those of the saint of the day, whether it's the new rite calendar, the old rite calendar, or it's the Eastern rite calendar, whatever calendar it is, it just drives them absolutely nuts about the particular saint. Now, sometimes you'll get a hold of a demon that has been, that's possessing somebody or influencing somebody that has, in point of fact, possessed someone else in the past, and they have been driven out by a particular saint or by driven out by someone on a particular feast day of a saint, and so the demons are particularly sensitive to that particular saint. So sometimes they'll come across that in the exorcisms. Then there's also, so if you have relics of saints, those can be very powerful in providing protection and warding off demons. There is the stone. St. Michael appeared in Bardonal, Italy, 5 times, and it's a wonderful story. You can go on the internet and get the information. They have an official website. Trying to navigate that thing is like anything else Italian. You can't find anything. I say that having lived in Italy for 2 years. But the cave has these little stones, and St. Michael of Purity said he wants people to take stones from the cave because he's chosen this cave and it's sacred to him. And basically what that meant is that God sanctified the cave and so people can take these little stones. I've had phenomenal success. One woman who was possessed, it only took 3 times to liberate her, and the third time I gave it to her, you didn't hear it, but there was this popping sensation about halfway through the ritual, and I sensed, and then I could see that she was reacting at the same time. Afterwards, she didn't have any problems, and that was the first time I'd actually used one, so I was quite content. Since then, I've used it all the time, but it's also something good to carry on yourself. You can write them, send them a donation. Usually, I tell people send them $50 and ask them for a stone, and they'll usually send it in a small reliquary, or they'll send you one with more than one, or however the case is, but they'll... they're good to carry with you and to use. Then there's the relics of the Passion. If you have a relic of the True Cross, that's pretty good. In the past, most priests, the only ones who ever had that, although it kind of, unless it was for public veneration, a particular location, which is very rare, if a priest had it, it was a sign that it was usually given to him by a bishop because he was an exorcist. And because it has it's extremely powerful relic. And that brings up a particular point. There are some things that work with some demons and some things that don't work with them at all. So you have to kind of find what the thing is that works on them and just beat them with it. Then there's the Agnus Dei, which is the parts of the the Paschal candle blessed in Rome. That's also quite useful to carry with you and that type of thing. We've already talked a little bit about private solemn exorcisms, which will drive them out, and Exum Christianorum. There's a thing called the spiritual contract. Now, usually people hear of like demonic contracts and things of that sort, my soul to the devil. There's that line, I don't know if you guys ever watched O Brother Art Thou, and the guy gets in and says, yeah, I sold my soul to the devil. And you did? He says, yeah, I wasn't using it. Anyway, the point is that whatever the demons do mirrors what is done. So the sacramentals, which the church teaches people to help them to lead a good Christian life, the demons do the opposite by using amulets and various other superstitious items. But there's always this mirroring that goes on, and one of the things that we have is a spiritual contract, which virtually nobody knows about, and is an unfortunate thing because it can really improve your spiritual life. And what a spiritual contract is it's a petition set up on the side of the individual to God, asking God, whenever I do this particular action, may this prayer be said, or may this thing be remembered. And so it's basically, so the person, all you have to do is kneel down and say, God, each time I make the sign of the cross, may the binding prayer against impurity, if you're struggling with impurity, be remembered or said for me. And so each time you would say it, it will have the effect, not exactly the same effect as saying the binding prayer, but it will have the same kind of effect as having the binding prayer. Demons react quite a bit to this if you set up a spiritual contract. I tell people set up spiritual contracts for every type of pious practice, and you can even set it up for breathing. I tell people that don't do that. Really stick with stuff that's actually religious, so that it's based on proper active devotion. So, but you like each time you make the sign of the cross, you know, may the binding curve be set over any child, my children that might be suffering from problems, or may the prayer to Saint Michael, you know, be said each time I genuflect and things of that sort. So you can actually get these, set up these spiritual contracts. And it's very similar to, you know, husbands and wives have this kind of, sometimes they usually get to a certain stage in the marriage where they can kind of communicate without saying anything. They just look at each other and they know what it means and, you know, from good and ill. But the point is that it's very similar to that whenever the person does it, even if it's unreflected, you know, as long as you make that habitual intention, whenever I do X, then each time the person does it, even if he's not thinking about it, he gets the effect of that particular prayer. Now, the demons have the opposite type of thing, a demonic contract, and that's usually to empower them, but that's because it's mirror. But doing spiritual contracts can be very beneficial to people, even in their own spiritual lives. Then there's, of course, devotion to Our Lady. Our Lady, by virtue of being Queen of Heaven and Earth, has perfect coercive power over demons. But she does not exercise it perfectly in the sense of exercising it to its fullest extent all the time, because then she'd be driving them all out all over the place, because her will is perfectly subordinated to God's, and so she only does it to the degree that God so chooses. And so having a strong devotion to her, though, can be very useful because of the fact that she can drive them out. St. Michael, obviously, since he's, you know, the head of the host of heaven that fights the battle. Guardian angel. Most people don't develop a basic relationship with the guardian angel at all, even though he's constantly taking care of them. Constantly. He's constantly vigilant. A lot of times they say, well, my guardian angel's not doing anything. Well, yeah, he's just constantly keeping things at bay. It's just that you don't experience it. Whereas people really should be praying to their guardian angel. And the reason you pray to him regularly in the state of Our Lady, the Saint Michael, and the other saints is that you become more subordinated to them, and then this divine authority structure takes into place, and you enjoy the effects of their protection. This is one of the reasons why you do it regularly with your guardian angel. Then there's Saint Joseph. He's particularly powerful in driving out demons, especially for fathers. One's particular patrons. So, St. Chad, for example, in my case, or St. Thomas Aquinas, I took him as my confirmation saint. It's kind of a funny story. The bishop, sometimes you got to kind of lighten this stuff up a little bit. The bishop, when I went up for confirmation, you know, because I was the shortest one, I was the first kid up there, right? And you had a little card. And the priest takes it and he says, Thomas Aquinas. The bishop just breaks out laughing. You know, as a kid, I don't understand that at that time, I didn't understand the political context of what that really meant. So I looked up and I said, did I do something wrong? He says, no. So he confirms it, right? Later, I went and asked him, I said, well, you know, what happened? He said, the bishop said he had been arguing with the priest who took the card for 2 hours about St. Thomas Aquinas, because this person was trying to say they should just take him off the books, nobody pays any attention to him anymore whatsoever, and then the first kid comes up, Thomas Aquinas. But anyway, your confirmation saints, in other words, your confirmation saints, the patron saints of the kids, your names, your family, this is another thing that just absolutely drives me into orbit. And that is when parents will name their kids after, you know, plug-in. Hey, plug-in, come on in over here, you know. You know, or, you know, it's, or Sterling. There's no Saint Sterling. The reason you name, and quite frankly, I think it's a sin against charity not to name your kid after a saint, because you don't provide him extra protection that he would get by putting him under the patronage of a saint. It's just not right. And one time, I had to go do an emergency baptism in a hospital, and I get up there, and the kid, it's one of those things where it could die right away or it could live to be 12, but in either case, it was never going to reach the use of reason because it had a particular kind of brain illness. And so, and it had just been born. And the parents wanted the child baptized. I said, okay. I said, so what's the daughter's name? They said, Weena. That's a witch's name. Oh, yeah, it's on some TV show. We just like the name, so we named it again. Witch. So I said, I'm not baptizing the kids. You know, pick a saint's name. What would you like? Mary. I said, that's good enough. But anyway, some of the way that people name their children is just unconscionable. And they should be trying to get the kids' patience to protect them. That also brings up the guardian angels of your wife or your husband or your children. I think you should be praying to them regularly to protect them and that type of thing. Or even your boss and things like that. Keep him from beating up on me all the time and chewing me up. Okay. Praying to the saint of the day, right, you know, when the saints have watched, get calendar, watch the feast. When the saints come up, watch that and pray to those particular saints of the day. The last thing I'm going to mention, of course, there's all sorts of different things that sometimes come up in particular people's, like if the demons are afflicting them with pride, well then say the litany of humility. And there's different prayers and different things that people can do to deal with particular kinds of demons. These are just general things that you can do. But one of it is, as I mentioned, throwing the Sacred Heart and Immaculate Heart in your home, because then that sets up this authority structure within the home, and so you enjoy certain effects of the enthronement. As a result of it. So those are some of the basic things that people can do in order to kind of keep the demons from affecting them or influencing them, or if they are influenced, to kind of drive them back and keep them at bay and that type of thing. Okay. We have a little bit of time, so what I'm going to do is there were some cards that were put in. Unless it's something that I really want to discuss here, if you put your email address on it, what I'm going to do is just email you the answer later. It might take a little while. Because of the writing that I've done and the fact that I used to teach and the fact that I've done I'm a bit overloaded on a social level. I spend between 4,000 to 6,000 minutes a month on a sales phone, and I get 400 to 600 emails a month. So I just don't. I don't have a lot of time. I will get to it. I promise. If I don't actually answer it, in specific cases. One of the questions is malignant narcissism or constant contrarian view. Yes, that is a sign of the demonic. What are they? Malignant narcissism is the person is always thinking about themselves, but in bad ways. Constant contrarian view, they're always a contrarian spirit. That's almost always a sign of some type of diabolic spirit. And you can bind it. Those, you can bind those. That's pretty effective in binding those, actually. My nephew is schizophrenic and has said he is possessed. Is it possible that his problems are demons? In most cases of schizophrenia, unless it's biologically based, that has happened. Let me put it this way. In every case that they've been labeled as schizophrenic, that I've come across that is not biologically based, it's demonic. And we can get fairly quickly, actually. Because usually what happens is schizophrenia is almost always a form of possession. So what you can do is that after you do a few sessions with them, you can usually get people that they'll do certain regimens of prayer and things like that. You can get them to the point where they can function and actually get out of that mental institution, which brings up a very interesting point. It was confirmed by another exorcist that I know of just recently because he started doing it in a mental institution. But in the late 1800s, there was a priest who was assigned to a mental institution in Italy as the chaplain. And so he got to look around and said, you know, I think a lot of these people are possessed. So he started exorcising everybody there. In 3 weeks, 80% of the people went home.
Wow.
To clean their own house.
Wow.
I don't know if the investors were particularly happy with that. Okay. That's a question I'll ask later. What is the proper age for men and women to date when you're ready to get married? Just answer very quickly when you're ready to get married.
45.
Well, actually, I have a very different view of that. I think that the way our educational system is set up in this country is doesn't serve nature well. Quite frankly, I think that we should go back to what was somewhat like in the Middle Ages in the sense that when you reached 8th grade, you were you either went to college or you learned a trade. This business of sitting in high school for 4 years not learning a thing and being annoyed to everybody has got to come to an end. Because what happens is they get to 18 years of age, they can't support themselves, they can't support a wife, and then they go to college, which should have been really done in high school because that's what it is. It's all been pushed back. So quite frankly, if they went to college and there was no handy-panky, you're going to study, you're really going to do your work, or you're going to learn a trade and get to the point where by the time you're 18 or 19 years of age, you can get married. Why is that important? Because nature is ready for women to start having children about 16, 17, 18, depending on the woman, and men a little bit older for maturation purposes. But the point is that that's when nature's ready. We push it off until they're 27, 28, 29, 30 years of age, and then we wonder why there's so much fornication. And it's also not good either because, I mean, when people do get married, it takes years for the point. They're usually in hock for years because of the fact that they want to live the lifestyle they came from right off the bat. Whereas if we set them up where they could actually get their college degree by the time they're 18 and maybe later if they're getting advanced degrees, then at least they would be prepared to support a family and they could actually get married at an early age. But the point is that the finality of dating, the very nature of dating, the action is ordered towards marriage. Well, you know, it's contraceptive in a sense to go out dating with no intention of getting married. So I just tell people, look, if you're not ready to get married, you're not ready to date. And the second thing is something that's very important. This usually goes off like a lead, goes off like a bomb. Is if you're not ready to have children, you're not ready to get married. So, because that's the nature of marriage is for. My child was conceived while I knew my husband didn't want a child. I was angry with him, so instead of telling him I was fertile, I said nothing. I'm concerned for the welfare of the resulting child. The general principle is this. If you don't see any problems, there's usually not one. I mean, it's pretty much what you see is what you get. With a few exceptions, sometimes they can lay hidden, but there's always some manifestation. So if you're not having any difficulties with the child, don't worry about it. If you are, if it's kind of like misbehaves a lot and unnaturally, then you know, have the priest do a blessing over them and see if the child kind of calms down a little bit, or feed the kid the water and holy oil and see if that helps. If it does, then take it to a priest and get the blessing. By using artificial birth control or obtaining a vasectomy, do individuals open themselves up to demonic possession? The answer is yes. Same thing with having your tubes tied and things of that sort. It does, yes. By a parent saying damning to a child, are they opening the child up to demonic possession? The answer is yes. I know a child that happened to. Okay. When a spouse knows there is a generational diabolical force in the other, how do you convince the spouse to seek help? Well, the first thing you have to do is pray that they receive the grace to be disposed to actually to seek the help. Sometimes, you know, usually if you pray for them for a while and you see some binding prayers, they'll get periods of lucidity about the thing, and you can just at that moment suggest, you know, don't you think you kind of have a problem with that? Yes. Well, maybe you should go see Father about it, you know, and then you tell Father, give him the blessing, you know, that sort of thing. So that's one of the things I very often will recommend. Why is loss of life not as promulgated as Fatima? I'm not answering that one. Why is it not promulgated as much as Fatima? I'm not sure. I think part of it is because people did. Fatima is more recent, is probably the real reason that people pay probably more attention to it. At least that would be my take on it. Maybe a few other reasons, too. What has been written about the possible connection of the homosexual abuse by priests to children and the influence of drug addiction and enemies of the church, specifically Freemasonry? Well, part of that also has to do with the fact that the communists, you know, this is something that's verifiable. I mean, it's right in public record. Ms. Dodd was the one who told us that basically that the communists actually tried to infiltrate the church by putting a thousand seminarians into the seminaries to influence the church eventually, and they said they were more experienced beyond their wildest dreams, the same thing with Freemasonry. The problem, and I'm sure that there is probably some type of connection. I mean, Freemasonry is a disordered form of worship. In fact, it's demonic ultimately. And so, like I said, you're going to end up with all these problems. And usually, once the contraceptive mentality takes over, in fact, that's a historical fact, there's not a single culture ever, historically, that didn't become contraceptive, that didn't also have a drastic rise in homosexuality at the same time. So this is something which there is a connection. I mean, there's a certain logic. I don't want to go into it all, but it's just one of those things that when we're not worshiping rightly, when priests aren't doing what they're supposed to do, you're going to end up with these kinds of problems. The other thing is that, you know, if a person has disorders, part of the problem is that very often priests make the mass about themselves, you know, and people kind of hang going to the mass upon the personality of the priest, and that's problematic. Well, if you're going to make it about themselves, and people perceive that, then you're going to attract into the center as homosexuals. Because why? They're narcissistic. They're kind of hung up on themselves. A vast majority of them, by vast I mean like 99% of them. And so what happens is that it's a respectable thing to enter into. They don't have to get the stigma of not getting married. They're around buddies they think are going to be around other men with his lifelike mind. And then they get to do this ritual each week, which everybody gets to look at them. You know. Yes, God enjoys beating up on demons and humiliating them. If it is correct to say joy, because if God loves all of his creation, would it not cause him pain to beat and humiliate and give a sense sadistic? Not really. You have to look at it from this perspective. If you're a virtuous parent, then using moderated corporal punishment, I'm sorry, but Dr. Spock and the modern culture don't trump scripture. Spare the rod, spoil the child. It's right in the Old Testament. God wrote it. That's it. That's the end of the discussion, as far as I'm concerned. Doesn't mean you beat your kid either, though. But the moral to the story is, what is the moral of the story? If the parents do it in a moderated way, and they know that it's correcting the children, and it comes not from their own anger, but from a desire to do what's good for the kid, and then they notice the kid becomes better as a result of it, there's actually a certain joy to take in correcting the kid, if they're rightly ordered. Well, it's the same thing with God. God looks at them and says, the just thing for you is to be punished, and so he punishes them. And so there's a delight in God in being just. Not in the fact that they are suffering, but in the fact that the suffering is due to them as a matter of justice. So he takes divide in his own justice, not in the actual punishment itself. Can angels take the Eucharist hook and give communion to lay people? Yes. It has happened on a few very, very rare occasions. What can parents do if their child, 19 years old, may not have been given an exorcism at infant, as an infant? That's always a big question. People come to me, the kid's acting up, and they'll say, well, I got my kid baptized in the new rite, they didn't use the... Now, you can do the exorcism in the new rite. I'm not having it the new rite at all. I'm just saying, if they would do it, we can have these problems. But they'll say, well, he's baptized in the new rite, the priest dispensed with it. Is there anything we can do? Can you supply the rites from the old rite? And the answer is no, you can't. There's been one case where I saw a dispensation that was given, but it's because the guy was possessed, at least in my estimation, was possessed. It was given only in that case, but it's not something that can really be done on that side. However, that's where the binding prayers, exum Christianorum, all these things can begin to provide protection for him, getting him out. If he's 18 years of age, he's got a decent spiritual life, having start saying it. If a child's life was in danger, so the mother gave baptismal blessing when the priest did arrive, he said, well, I guess we don't really have to do anything. Actually, there is the supplying of rites, which he has an obligation to do. And if it hasn't been supplied, then you can go have it supplied in the old rite if you like. What happens to your soul if you die under demonic possession? Depends on the state. If it's in the state of grace, which can happen, it goes to heaven. If it's not, it goes to hell. So it's they only have possession of your body, not your soul. So, and they can't touch your soul. So if you are in the state of grace, it doesn't affect it. Possession of the smallest. I presume that means by the children or that type of thing. And Morph makes the observation, the head exorcist around makes the observation, as you deal with it, you don't see that stuff as much in our culture, unless it's generational, than you do in other cultures where there's a lot of superstitious practices. But a Morph talks about how very often the women, if they don't like a particular woman, they'll hex the kid that she's carrying, and then the kid ends up with all these malformations and that type of thing. This is one of the reasons why I'll ask women, oh yeah, I'm pregnant, how long have you been pregnant? It's 5 months. Have you got the blessing for pregnancy? No. Okay, get in here. Because it actually was asks for God to assign an angel to protect the child and to guide its birth. And recently there was a woman, she was 8 months pregnant, and I gave her the blessing, and the kid was born, came out of the womb with the cord completely around its neck. They were absolutely flabbergasted that he didn't die in the process. And we're convinced it has to do with the blessing. But the point is that they can become possessed in the womb. And this is one of the reasons our church always did the exorcisms and also to break generational spirits. But it can happen to children who are quite young. It can even happen to children who they're even exorcised at birth and that type of thing. But anyway, you just have to do your part to make sure that they're properly exorcised. Are Catholics responsible for other teachings of the Church that our parish priests or local dioceses may not emphasize? Yes, it's called the sin of negligence. Even if your parish priest doesn't tell you everything, because the pulpit is a limited thing. You can't tell everybody everything. There is to know from the pulpit. It's just there's not enough time for it. So each Catholic has, that's why you have catechism, adult CCD, and a variety of different educational things. But the Catholics should each have a good catechism, have gone through it thoroughly and know the teachings, and the Church says we have an obligation to continue educating ourselves according to our state in life. That means as a priest, he has to continue educating himself, and so with lay people, according to their state. I usually recommend the catechism by Spirago because it's so thorough. It's catechism explained, put out by 10. The new catechism has, it's written in theological language, so I usually don't recommend it to lay people. I tell them, you're probably better off getting something that's a little more accessible. So that's usually the one I recommend. You just go through it slowly and give you quite a bit of knowledge. Can we pick and choose which teachings to follow and get to heaven? Well, here's the issue. You can't get to heaven without having rectitude of the will. What's rectitude of the will? Love of God and submission to God. That rectitude of the will, you can't have rectitude of the will, it's a blind faculty, without God giving, without the proper knowledge. So that means that without rectitude of the will, you have to have faith, you have to have the right kind of faith. Which is why St. Thomas says that even for baptism of desire, you actually have to have at least some infused faith, and that means a person has to have at least knowledge of the Trinity and the Incarnation. That's a debated point. But the point is that you have to have right faith. Now, what I'm about to say has to be understood in an exact way. Nobody in heaven is a non-Catholic. doesn't mean that people who aren't Catholic in this life don't get into heaven. It just means by the time they get there, it gets straightened out in the process. So the point being is that either at their final judgment in purgatory, that's all straightened out. So, but just kind of keep that in mind. The point being is that if you're a Catholic and you knowingly reject something of the Catholic faith, as Christ says, without faith you cannot be saved. And by, if you have a single act of heresy corrupts the virtue of faith, as the virtue of faith is that in the state of grace that gets you into heaven. So that's just to kind of keep in mind.